Well, as we come to a conclusion for this course, I thought it'd be helpful for us just again to think together at the very beginning of this hour about a very basic question, right? And that's, why do we study church history? Why do we do a course in the Sunday school context like this, where we look at the past as Christians? What do we learn from studying church history? I think you probably have a lot of different ideas, right? We situate ourselves in a story. We know where we come from. We kind of see the things that that make us who we are today in terms of how we think, the traditions that develop and that kind of thing. I like to think about it, too, in terms of how when we look at the past and we learn from the past as Christians, we see three things about the past that help us understand not only church history, but a little bit about the church in the present and sort of how it sits within a larger story. Story of God's people and God being with God's people throughout time. I mean, one of the first things I'd like to point out when we think about why we study church history, what do we learn from the study of church history, is that it's a messy story. Right? It's messy. Right? And we've seen some of that this month together, right? We've seen a lot of messiness. Why is church history so messy?
It's disheartening.
Yeah. Well, why is it disheartening?
Human nature.
Because we're messy, right? We're messy. We do things to each other that we're not proud of, right? We look at the story of the past and we see, along with the good, we see a lot of bad. We see even some ugly, right? I think back, I can go to my parents' house in New York City tomorrow if I wanted to, and they have a house full of photographs, some of which that go back to sort of my more awkward teenage years I would love to never see again, right? Just delete from the record. But being a parent now, not only of teenagers, but also of a college student, I think I appreciate the value of those photographs to my parents in ways that I probably hadn't before. But yeah, we all have things in our past, right, that we're not proud of, right? And we look at the church's past and we see a lot of those things as well. So it's a messy story. But it's also a hopeful story. And that's something that I hope that even as we look at, as we looked at lots of sort of messy things in the last few weeks together, we never forget that the story of the church is a hopeful story for a couple of reasons, right? For one, it's hopeful because we always see in whatever context we're looking at, whatever situation we're studying, that as messy as things are, God's people are always aspiring towards some standard of faithfulness, right? Trying to interpret the scriptures, apply them faithfully to their surroundings, understanding sort of where we fit in the world. We see the church always aspiring to live into its ideals, right? To be faithful, to worship right, to think correctly, to serve God the way that God would want us to serve God. But that's not the primary reason that the church's story is hopeful, right? Sure, we see God's people trying to do the right thing. But ultimately, the church's story is hopeful because it's God's story. Right? The story of God being with God's people, and even through the worst of the things that we see, right, we are nevertheless convinced that God has not and will not abandon His people, right? So we can see that in the story of the church throughout all the different contexts and periods that we look at in church history. But the third reason that we look at the church's history, and this is something that I hope that we can spend some time thinking about and talking about together today, is that it's our story, right? It's a story that we, as 21st century Christians, claim as our own, right? It's something that we locate ourselves within. We appreciate when we look at the past that God is not only gathering for Himself one people from every tribe and tongue and language and nation, as it teaches us in Revelation chapter 5, right in Scripture, but also one people across the span of time. Right? And church history enables us to appreciate that, that there is a real sense in which the people that we study in the past are members of our community. Right? And so listening to them, studying them, learning from their mistakes even, these are all ways for us to hear from members of our community, just like we listen to each other in the present, right? We look at the past and we hear from the past. Today, what I'd like to do is to bring this course to a conclusion by looking at just one more theme. That's the theme of religious identity in the Reformation period, and then leave some time for discussion. Because I think one of the angles on the past and the church's history that we've lifted up in this last month is not only how the church has developed theology to make sense of its surroundings, but one of the things I've tried to highlight also is how, as we've developed our theology, that has had consequences, right? Not only for Christians, but also for others. And that's one of the things that we've highlighted in our time together. And today, we want to spend just a few minutes at the beginning thinking about how the diversity of different commitments, not only outside of Christianity, but even within Christianity, Protestant and Catholic, we looked at the Anabaptists as well, the cultural differences between different groups, the disruptive experiences of exile. We talked about how violence led people to move, to migrate. We talked last week about how that experience was fraught, not only for those who left and had to go somewhere, but also for those places that received them, right? These were not easy changes to navigate. And we want to talk about how these kinds of changes in the 16th century, where they were so intense over such a short period of time, affected the way in which Christians explained who we are. What does it mean to be the church, the people of God? What does it mean to be faithful to God? And so where I thought we would drop right in is from a voice in our own Reformed tradition. We looked a little bit at him as one of several quotes last time, or several figures last time that we quoted John Calvin. Here's a quote that he from his answer to the Nicodemites, and we'll explain what that means in just a second, from 1544. It's printed right here on your handout. They keep their heart for God, at least they say so, but they have no difficulty abandoning their bodies to profound and harmful things. How can God be pleased with such a mixture? Can the one who said that every knee shall bow before him and every tongue confess his name suffer anyone to kneel before idols? I also want to let them know that it is a great ingratitude on their part that they use words, the words that they take up. Since Calvin acts so brave, why does he not come here in order to see how he will fare? My doctrine is not hard, but it is the hardness of their hearts that leads them to find it so. So Calvin is identifying a problem here. What's the problem that he's identified? Yeah, there's a way that certain people are acting that he's not pleased with. And how are they acting? How does he describe it anyway in the quote that I've given you? Yeah, they kneel before idols. And they assume some kind of a distinction, right? That they can keep their heart for God, at least they say that, yet they have no difficulty, as Calvin describes, abandoning their bodies to profound and harmful things. And then he says explicitly, that's just idolatry, what they're doing. What he's describing here, and you can get this too from the title of his treatise, is a phenomenon in the 16th century that came to be known as Nicodemism. right? You certainly probably get the echo of the name right from the New Testament, Nicodemus. Remember Nicodemus? John chapter 3, the fourth gospel. Who was Nicodemus? He was a Pharisee, teacher, Jewish teacher of the law, who was curious about Jesus' teaching. But when we read about Nicodemus' first encounter with Jesus, how does he approach Jesus? Does he kind of come to Jesus in the middle of a public assembly and say, "Teach me, I want to learn from you"? No, he went to Jesus at night because he was concerned that he would be seen with this controversial teacher. So he went to Jesus undercover. Calvin, as far as we know, is the first person to use this term, Nicodemite, to describe certain kinds of behavior, certain kinds of people. These were people that he and others accused, of hiding their religious convictions. He had in mind particularly French Protestants who, for reasons that he associated with fear of persecution, fear of discrimination, because they were Protestants or they chose to believe something different about their faith, right, than the Catholic belief, hid their faith. In essence, they went to Jesus undercover, right, at night. How do they hide their faith? Well, they live just like they had prior to changing their beliefs. The idolatry that he talks about here is not the kind of, you might imagine lots of different possibilities, but what he simply means is the Roman Mass, right, the Catholic Mass, with what Protestants at that time considered to be an idolatrous ritual at the heart of it, right? The Eucharist, the Roman Eucharist, where Christ was believed to be present as the elements were transubstantiated into his body and blood, and then a new sacrifice was offered, right? That, to Calvin and other reformers, was considered an abomination for different reasons. So Calvin is calling out those who say, "Hey, you know, I disavow those practices and the theology behind those practices. I'm committed to this new way of understanding the gospel, right, and understanding the authority of Scripture. Yet, I'm going to continue to go and play the part of a good Catholic." Why is Calvin so agitated about this? Why not just let this happen? Why make a fuss, right? I mean, isn't it understandable that people don't want to put themselves in harm's way? Like, what if you were in a situation where your beliefs all of a sudden, you know, put you and your family perhaps in danger? Wouldn't it be understandable if you, for the sake of peace and safety, just kind of went along with the way things always have been? Yeah, go ahead.
Two things I think of. One is, it's not being honest.
Okay, yeah.
You know, they're not being honest with themselves.
Sure.
They're not being honest with others. But then the other part, I mean, we don't talk about the problem as being an evangelist, but it's hard to evangelize in any way, shape, or form, or bring people, you know, in
Yeah, that's great. Those are some of his concerns, right? First, he doesn't often say that this is a matter of honesty and integrity, but that's exactly not exactly that way. But that's the argument, right? For him, this disjuncture between what you might say is your inward faith and your outward behavior, that's dishonoring to God, right? That for Calvin, right? He argues that there ought to be a fundamental integrity between what we believe and how we act. In fact, he's fond of saying that true faith begets true confession, right? So a genuine faith cannot but show itself outwardly in a way that's consistent with that faith. Secondly, yeah, right? If you're going to like hide undercover and nobody knows that you've embraced this new faith, how can you possibly, right, be a good example to others, right? I think for Calvin, one of the issues for him too was that being present in Roman Catholic worship was a matter of idolatry, right? You didn't even have to participate in the ritual. Just to be present for Calvin was problematic because there might be others who were struggling with whether or not this way of being or this way of worship was proper. And if they knew that you didn't think it was, but you were still there, that could be a stumbling block, right? Or that could be a problem for others. So Calvin, in a series of treatises and letters and sermons over 30 years, took on this issue of Nicodemism, right? He basically said, this is not permissible. It's not permissible for you if you change your theological commitments to continue to practice in this old way, embodying the kind of theology that we've rejected. For Calvin, if you find yourself in that situation, you have two options. He was consistent on this topic from 1530s all the way up to the 1560s when he died, right? He was consistent in saying, look, these would-be Nicodemites have two options. What are the two options, according to Calvin? And we've covered these, not directly related to Calvin, but in our time together this past month, we've covered these options. What could you do? If the one option that was forbidden was to stay and do nothing, right? What were the two options that you could choose?
Stand.
Yeah, you could stand up and resist, right? Speak out, right? Say, I'm not doing that. Even if it's required by law, I'm not going there, right? Because I reject this form of worship. And of course, that would bring some risk with it, right? You could potentially be arrested. You know, in France, we read about violence against Protestants. You could potentially be killed, right? So resistance could bring with it persecution right up to martyrdom, right? So that is a possibility. In fact, that's a possibility that Calvin names in this quote when he said people are complaining about him. He said, oh, this Calvin, he says all this stuff, but let's see how tough he would be if he was back here. Right? Would he be talking so tough? What did that tell us? That tells us that Calvin didn't choose that option, even though that was one of the options that he held forth. What was the other option? If you weren't going to resist in place, leave. Flee. Like he did. Right? Go somewhere where you can worship God in the way that God requires. Right? For Calvin, that meant leaving his homeland. We talked about his story of flight and exile, right? Going to a place like Geneva, participating in the Reformation in Geneva. And so that was also an option. So for Calvin, for Nicodemus, there are always two options. You could resist in place, facing whatever consequences might come your way, or you can flee, right? You can go, you can choose exile to a place where you can worship freely. Yeah, Dan. Yeah, absolutely. Right, right. So say more about how those two options represent hypocrisy or intolerance.
So if you're hiding your faith, pretending mm-hmm. to go along with it, that's hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If on the other hand you're saying, well, if I can't worship freely, if I can't exert my opinion, I have to go to some place where I can, that sets up, well, not only do I have to practice my faith in my way, that needs to be the way for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you're getting to, in terms of what Calvin is doing in making that kind of statement, is he's drawing a boundary around the church and saying this is what it means to be pure in our faith and in our worship. This is what it looks like. And it is a inflexible boundary, right? It is one that will not tolerate even presence amongst the other, right? Separation is what Calvin is calling for, right? If separation, either in the form of this speaking out in place and just rejecting, I'm going to stay in France and I'm going to refuse to worship this way even if I die and become a martyr, or I'm going to leave and flee. Now, there's a lot of complexity here, right? Because we know that many people followed Calvin's advice, right? And so we know that there were plenty of people who, either by choice or being forced to do so, left places where this new Protestant and Reformed confession was illegal, right? They couldn't practice freely. They left. Many from France, like Calvin, left, right? And that led to the formation of all of these various exile communities in different places, needing to negotiate religious difference in other places. We know that some people resisted, right? They resisted. They resisted even to the point of death, and we'll talk more about them in a second. And then we also assume, I'm not going to say that we know, because one of the interesting things about this phenomenon of hidden religion is that it's hidden, right? We don't know how many Nicodemites really existed. There's no way for us to know, right? Because if they were successful in hiding their beliefs, they would have left no trace. In fact, I think it's easy for us to imagine, when I described earlier this group of hidden Protestants who, because of fear, blended in imperceptibly with Catholic worship, right? That's easy for us to imagine. But if I asked us to pick one out from a crowd, there's no way for us to do that. In fact, most of what we think about this group is taught to us by their enemies. People like Calvin, people like other theologians that say that this group must exist and speak out against this kind of behavior, we have very little documentary evidence that points us to an actual Nicodemite. Right? Think about it. Right? If you wanted to, if you spoke out against a group that was afraid of being known, one of the things that you could be certain about is that you're not going to have anyone talk back to you, right? It's like, because they're not going to say, hey, yeah, exactly, you got me. That's not what happened. And so you sort of see how this kind of rhetoric that Calvin used to call out this kind of behavior had a way of articulating, remember the question we started with, who are we? What are the boundaries around God's people that make us discernible, right? And for Calvin, this was, we have to separate from Rome, even at the cost of our lives. Like, he called the Nicodemite way of being illegitimate, right? So he takes that group, real or imagined, and I bet that it's real. I mean, there, you can imagine there are people who hid their faith. We just don't know how many there were. And he locates them on the outside. So it's like me talking to you and saying, hey, you know, there are some who say that they're with us, but they're not willing to show their true colors. They're not really with us. And so what I've done there is I've placed in your imagination a category of a kind of person who doesn't belong, right? Who is no longer part of us. I've drawn a boundary around our community. So Calvin is doing that with this sort of rhetoric against Nicodemism, against crypto-religion, hiding one's faith. Yeah. Luther wasn't a fan of James, yeah.
So, I mean, what you said, I think, is very important. We get into the faith versus works.
Sure, yeah.
Discussion, works are what you can see. Mm-hmm. Faith is what you can't see. You will even deserve it, right? This becomes a continuum. You know, where you draw the line. Somebody, I'm struggling with this, where you draw the line on somebody who isn't, you know, following in the footsteps of
And I think that is precisely the kind of difficult question of religious identity that we're getting at here. Because Calvin draws a line a certain way, but he wasn't the only position. There are others like Martin Bucer who for a time argued a different position, saying, you know, love of neighbor requires you to stay where you are, even if you believe differently, even if you see manifest idolatry in your midst. Because how else will things change if you're not present, right, to bring about that change? So there was a diversity of opinion there. I think the other part of it, too, is if you were a Nicodemite, how did you view yourself? Did you view yourself as Catholic and an idolater, the way that Calvin says that you are? Or do you sort of see yourself as, no, I mean, I understand my identity in terms of my beliefs, not necessarily in terms of the kinds of practices that flow out of them. So there's a whole spectrum of different ways of understanding how you fit into this mix that I think comes into focus when we realize when these things are happening, they create these kinds of questions, right? One example, so if you just flip over to the next page, very briefly, one example of speaking out, as it were, was what happened to many Protestants and Catholics, frankly, during the English Reformation. The English Reformation, we could do an entire class, right? Talking about how the Reformation in England looked a certain way, differently from other places in Europe, particularly with the monarchy the way that it was, and you had Henry VIII, Edward VI, these Tudor monarchs, right, that went to Protestantism, and then within the succession, you had Mary, Queen Mary, known as Bloody Mary for her persecution of Protestants, a Catholic queen, right, for 5 years in there before Elizabeth I became queen for a long reign and essentially established Protestantism in England, Britain for good, right? But in the movements of the English Reformation, you had this back and forth, right? Protestant monarch, Protestant nation, Catholic monarch, Catholic nation, Protestant monarch, and that was quite disruptive. That led to the persecution, even the execution of those who didn't belong to the established official religion. What you have here on the back of your handout are some illustrations from John Fox's Acts and Monuments, right? Known colloquially as Fox's Book of Martyrs. And this was a work produced during the reign of Queen Elizabeth. It was a work of Protestant propaganda that was articulating a way of thinking about the Church of England, right, as being established through the blood of martyrs, particularly during the reign of Mary, right, that this was a time in which God tested the Church and people spoke out courageously, lost their lives. Thomas Cranmer was one of them. He was one of the architects of the Reformation in England, who helped bring Protestant conviction to England, under the reign of Henry VIII, under the reign of Edward VI. He was the primary author of the Book of Common Prayer, right? So he was Archbishop of Canterbury, and we know that during the reign of Queen Mary, he first recanted his Protestantism, then he recanted of his recantation. Ultimately, he was executed in 1556. You have an account of this in Fox's Book of Martyrs, and you have accompanying illustrations, right? You have the trial of Thomas Cranmer, this is the top illustration here, and then you have the actual representation of his burning, right? Where, again, he's quite serene, confident, right? Preaching, right, as it were, till the very end, faithful to the end, right? And there's a message there for readers, or even if you're not able to read, right, for those who see this picture. What's the message? Yeah, right, that he was firm on his convictions, that he believed this and he was willing to die for it, and that when, even at the moment of death, he had no doubts about the rightness of his position. Now here's the question. Cranmer is a famous example. He's an influential example of somebody who died for their faith, but he was not alone, right? We looked at this the second week of our class together, right? Martyrdom was a reality that many experienced, and it was one that was experienced across confessional groups. So it wasn't just Protestants, but it was Catholics as well. It was Jews, it was Muslims. Yeah, go ahead.
So was that viewed as, when people were living, as attractive, as an outcome?
Yeah, so here's the thing, right? Remember we read about the Anabaptist communities who began to view their suffering as a mark of their identity as God's people? Because everywhere they went, they suffered because they didn't have their own political... territory. They didn't have the acceptance neither from the Catholics nor from the Protestants. Their views on baptism were viewed as not only heretical but also seditious, right, politically dangerous. And so more Anabaptists died than any other groups, and they began to interpret that in terms of, well, that must be what it means to be God's people, right? To bear the cross, to suffer, to die. And so for that community, that was viewed as a very positive outcome. But to answer your question, let me ask you this. Would this have been viewed as a positive outcome? What do you think? To the living. And you read about Thomas. That's exactly right. It depends on who you're asking. Right? I mean, to those who didn't think the way that he did, this was a positive outcome, not because they wanted to be like Cranmer, but because they got rid of another one of those heretics. Well, that's the thing. The question that I'm trying to get at is, when we talk about martyrdom, we assume that somebody dies for their faith, they're a martyr. But that's not the case, because there are plenty of people who didn't think that about them. Yeah, go ahead. Some of it, yes.
How the church is, how the worship service is conducted.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where this quarrel is, or does it have anything to do with how people live in the world?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it?
Yeah. So
the fighting is, do you do this a certain way that's sort of more like the Catholics, or more like the Protestants, or more like the Anabaptists, or whatever? But it all has to do with what happens inside the church.
Yeah. No, it's relevant. I mean, so that's where you have clergy getting married, and that, of course, is a marker of Protestant identity. So ultimately, it's a difference in interpretation of scriptures, a difference in understanding of theology that has its first expressions in the liturgical context of worship. So there's a great difference between worship. You saw how Catholics were describing Protestant worship in terms of this inversion of what's right, right? This sort of sacrilege. You see the same sort of thing on the Protestant side. Calvin's describing that here. So that certainly is a place where differences in theology emerge. But because we believe that our theology doesn't just norm our liturgical life, but all of life, you see differences beyond that as well. We could spend an entire class talking about those differences, but some examples are who gets to get married, whether clergy can get married or not, whether or not we have a societal practice of begging, right? Where under sort of Roman Catholic thinking, there was a place for that, not only on the part of those who are begging for support as members of certain religious orders, but those who gave, they gave meritoriously, right? They gave as a way of expressing their devotion to God and acquiring righteousness through that, right? So that it had wide-ranging implications because our theology is never limited to just our liturgy. So, but in this case, we have back to the question of who makes the martyr. Who creates the martyr?
The people that think like that.
The community does, right? The community does, right? Martyrdom is an interpretation that a community makes concerning a particular event, a particular death. And what the reason we want to talk about it a little bit today is because that's another way in which this activity that I described and I attributed to Calvin of boundary drawing, of marking who we are, what our commitments are, was done in the 16th century, right? The martyr, in many ways, certainly, right, in many cases, they went to their death because they did not compromise on their beliefs. Yet after they died, their story was most useful, not for the martyr, because, I mean, they're dead, but for the community as a way of reinforcing the community's identity. This is what one of us looks like. These are the principles that we stand for. These are the principles worth dying for. And then, of course, as I intimated earlier, on the other side of that, there was the Catholic regime of Queen Mary, right? This guy's not a martyr. He's a heretic. And we are doing the right thing by carrying out God's sentence of judgment against this heretic. Again, this is another place where groups were on various sides of Christian commitments, right? Protestants and Catholics, identifying themselves in opposition to one another. What I'd like to do, yeah, okay, so go ahead. Some hands. So I think this is great. Yeah. So does anybody think that God is okay with killing heretics? And so this is great because this is precisely where I'd like to go with our conversation. I mean, it does seem so gruesome. It does seem so foreign to us, this kind of behavior. And I think one of the things that makes church history so important for us to engage in is to imagine that, yeah, there was a time and there are reasons, right, that people thought precisely that God not only okayed it, but that God demanded it, right, that was a way of ensuring pure. If you think back to an earlier session of our time together, right, we talked about I have it listed here. I see the hands. I'll get to these questions in a second. You have here on the second group of terms under discussion: purity, contagion, purgation. Right? One of the reasons why over the last 3 weeks I've given us so many different examples from different groups doing terrible things to each other in the name of religion is precisely because I was trying to point out that across these various groups, there was a similar dynamic that can be discerned, right? A sense that our group should look a certain way, should be a certain way. This is what constitutes purity. Why does that matter? Not just because we care about it, but particularly in that religious context, God demands that. This was a time when impurity could be disastrous, right? It could be destructive to the body of Christ. Why? Because it could invite God's judgment, right? And so once we have a sense of, well, what are the boundaries that define who we are, then what comes into focus? That there are groups among us, around us, who threaten that integrity because they believe things that reject God's truth. They practice things that we can only describe as idolatry. They reject Christ in the case of Jewish people, for example. And so the logic, and this is hard for us as 21st century Christians, I think, but the logic in that late medieval, early modern period was that these types of outsiders were contagions, a threat to the purity. And how do you deal with that? Well, you have to purge, right? Whether it's via exile, sending out, right, or violence, right? And that was a dynamic that comes out again and again and again in all of these, because it's a matter of divine command and avoiding divine judgment. And if you remember from week 2, we talked about how people were experiencing famine and war and disease. And it was a very easy step to go from, why are we experiencing these things, to, could it be because we've not dealt sufficiently with these contagions or these heretics in our midst? And so you have theological justification for moving against these other groups. Okay, so a bunch of hands. Yeah, Dan. Yeah, yeah. So exactly. So one of the things. So hold that thought. We'll come right back to it. Yeah.
One of the things that has not changed is that if you belong to a particular denomination or whatever, you still are. There's fear. People cannot use their imaginations, ask questions, and because if you ask questions, it could be blasphemous. People don't raise their hand and ask questions when someone's giving a sermon. When you have a topic of Christian imagination, it stunts the growth of religious belief to not question. And people that ask questions, if Jesus were asked questions, he would invite them. He would invite those questions. But in the church, you don't ask questions. You believe the right things so that you can be accepted. So there's still fear. Even though there's no burning at the stake, there's no persecution, people are still afraid. You don't talk about religion when you're in the public because of fear. So fear still exists.
Yeah, so fear still exists. A kind of violence still exists. I think one of the things that we see here, and I've tried to present it as sympathetically as possible, I've tried to explain the logic behind why people were seemingly to us, right, illogically willing to do these kinds of things to other people, to explain it in terms of a robust understanding of this is what God requires. This is what devotion to God requires. This is what purity of the church requires. And we see in the different examples that we looked at this past month, right, that what they were doing in that period always involved a kind of identifying who we are, making that very clear. And then, of course, the other side of that coin is, as you do that, you then begin to get a sense of who they are on the outside, right? So there is this kind of movement towards a us and them. And again, that is tied into this idea that our well-being, our faithfulness as God's people, our commitment to God, right, demands a kind of separation from or a dealing with impurity. The question that was raised about why do people like really believe this? And I think that really does sort of, you know, get us to a place where it seems so foreign to us, right? How can people have been willing to kill over liturgical stuff or belief over baptism? How could that be? That seems so drastic, right? It seems so barbaric. And I think it should. I'm not going to poll the group, but I would hope that if I polled the group, everybody would say, yeah, that's not a good idea, right? That's not the way that we think, right? It just seems so strange. And I think history reminds us of that, because we do not live in the 16th century, right? We do not live in exactly the same context. And so we don't have this like one-to-one. There's a strangeness to the past that should be strange to us. But at the same time, as some of the comments, the recent comments were made, I think there are ways in which, and I'd like to just spend some time talking about this together, this idea of purity, I see your hand, Ted, purity, contagion, and purgation, although we're not quick to pick up arms and join a mob against the church down the street, these ways of thinking are still very much with us. Dan mentioned sort of the political realm, right, where you have this all or nothing. You're either with me or against me, right? And we talked about how in the past, in order to legitimize violence against another, you almost had to dehumanize them. We read some of these descriptions, whether it's of Protestants or Catholics or witches or whatever it might be, that were so absurd in some ways, but they were rhetorically designed to make it so that the person that you looked at wasn't in the same category as you, so that you could then say or do whatever, right? And I think there are ways in which we might see some of that in our discourse today. Okay.
So, when you're talking about the discourse today, you might hear thrown around the idea as an example of something that is terrible to say that, well, there are two sides to this. And, think of the racist marching in Charleston, where people said, no, there's not, there are not good people on both sides. There's right and there's wrong. And that becomes a metaphor for a lot of stuff where people say, no, we can't tolerate stuff that's wrong. So that's the argument for intolerance. The argument for tolerance, I think, or tolerance of diversity in the thought, would come straight, in my mind, from Jesus, who says that the highest command is to love your neighbor. Well, your neighbor is not ever going to think exactly as you think. Never. And I think that human tendency to distinguish self from other and revile the other or despise the other is the root of much of the sin that we live.
Great points. Any other comments? I think this is something that, I would feel bad if we left today without having had some time to reflect on these contemporary connections, right? In what ways do we see, perhaps in different forms, hopefully in different forms, similar dynamics of drawing boundaries, thinking in terms of purity, contagion, purging the other. Yeah. Because, I mean, the fact of the matter is, Christianity as a faith makes some pretty unique claims, right? Absolute claims. Claims about the divinity of Jesus, claims about the humanity of Jesus, claims about the Trinity. These are things that, again, you find some diversity of opinion within Christianity, but by and large, the church has considered to be, right, non-negotiable, right? And so you raise a great question. How do you keep from, on some measure, in some ways, right, drawing the boundaries, keeping the lines, right? Is there a way to do that, though, without maybe doing it the other way or taking it to the next step, which is then to, like, purge disagreement? I don't know. I mean, I'm interested in sort of hearing comment, questions. Yeah, I mean, I think this is the... Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, jump in.
Well, in many ways, the same human emotion defines ISIS. And they define any number of groups over time. Mm-hmm. Same stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think... And I think there's plenty of conversation to be had about this. I think one of the things that we might learn from this as Christians is to see from the history of the church the ways in which how we disagree can be so violent, can be so sub-Christian. And I mean, this comes into focus when you see various Christian confessions, even who are by and large committed to the same theology, still acting in violence towards the other, needing to purge the other. I think what it does is it makes us aware. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, so that's using religion as a political leverage.
Yeah, it makes us aware of the ways that we do that today. It makes us aware of the ways in which maybe we might be more sophisticated in violence, right? Speech is violence. I mean, I think it's always, I mean, you can just turn on the news and you can hear, it doesn't matter what your perspective is on various political issues, you can see how speech is used as violence to destroy, right? To kill, right? To send to exile, right? The other. And I think being aware of the ways in which we speak about this, I think there's also, I think, a way in which maybe, again, I certainly, as a Christian, I'm not advocating for, conceding our distinctive theology, but I think a Christian imagination is sort of getting to some of the things that we might maybe just chew on together, leaving this class. Like, what does that look like? What does it look like? I had mentioned some examples from the teaching of Jesus or the example of Jesus. What would it look like maybe to disagree with others better than we do, right? I think one of the reasons why we did a class, I did a class on Reformation at the margins, was that it stretched our imagination. It stretched our imagination because I think we're used to thinking of the Reformation one way, and what I've tried to do week after week was to get us to think a little bit about the people whose theology, the people who were affected by the implications of Christian theology or the implications of a particular group's beliefs. And I wonder, too, if one of the take-homes from doing this together might make us, in our engagement with others, more empathetic, or just at least aware that there are others who are affected, right, by the positions that we hold. Yeah, go ahead. Things, you know, one of the ways that I would embrace that as well is like, yeah, I think it's helped me in doing this work to think both about how when I engage with other people, it makes me more aware of differences. It makes me more aware that there's another side. And that even if I don't change my view, I am at least open to the possibility that I might be wrong about something, right? And I think that is missing in some of the examples that we've looked at in the past, right? When you're so clear about something that you're willing to kill somebody about it, you better be right, right? And I think, but when we take a wide angle look on the past and we see how there really were well-meaning folks, right? Particularly even within the Christian camp, right? Who believed themselves, even in the case of martyrdom, right? You two very different interpretations of the same death, both of which were looking to God to validate their interpretation. I think given that propensity through the ages, it makes me less trusting of my own confidence sometimes. Again, not that we don't have confidence in our theology that's been handed down to us and that we find so nourishing and edifying and helpful, and truth, which we believe is something that's real. Yet at the same time, I think the ways in which we hold this truth, particularly vis-a-vis others, I hope that our time studying church history together might have equipped us with a more expansive way of thinking about those kinds of conversations, right? As we engage them, and maybe even catching ourselves slipping into a mode of purity, contagion, right, purgation. So thanks so much for the invitation to come and spend a month with you. I enjoy coming to Westminster. Thanks for being such a lively group to engage this material. And if you have questions after class, weeks from now even, you have my email, you have a way to contact me. I'm more than happy to engage in further conversation. This is important stuff, and I'd love to talk with you more about it. So thank you so much for your time.